Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. This week, in honor of The Incredible Hulk, Adam and I share our top five movies that successfully made the transition from the TV screen to the silver screen.
Plus, your feedback on Sex and the City, Massacre Theater, music by Shame Train, and a review of M. Night Shyamalan's latest thriller, The Happening.
But first, don't make Film Spotting angry. You wouldn't like us when we're angry.
I've got a problem. There are aspects of my personality that I can't control.
See a shrink?
It's a little bit more complicated than that.
Bruce, trust me when I tell you, I've heard them all.
Not this one.
We've never seen anything even close to your level of exposure. That you survived an event like that, it's beyond my comprehension.
When David Banner becomes angry, he transforms into a giant green Hulk of a man. Now, the hardest obstacle for a filmmaker to overcome when dealing with the Hulk is probably the Hulk himself. How do you portray a two-story tall giant? You can't just throw some tights on him, a la sort of Bruce Wayne or Superman. Unless you cast Lou Ferrigno to play the Hulk, you're going to probably go the route of CGI. And that's what director Louis Leterrier does here. But unfortunately, when you do that, you run the risk of your movie living in Jar Jar Binks' Last Starfighter land, computer graphics alienating the audience. So my question to you, Adam, is do we like Bruce Banner in this movie when he's angry?
It's a great question. It was certainly the big issue I had and many people had with Ang Lee's version of the Hulk a few years back. The CGI was so distracting with the Hulk that it just took everyone out of the picture, myself included. But it's a lot better here. I think that the Hulk is way more human in this version. But you're right that part of what I loved about Iron Man, for example, was Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark and knowing that that was him behind the suit. Michael Keaton and Christian Bale as Batman. I like seeing them and knowing that they're behind the suit and you get their personalities.
Ed Norton is lost here once he becomes the Hulk.
Yeah, I agree. He is literally lost. He's not anywhere to be found. And the Hulk is always going to be at a disadvantage cinematically, as you suggested, because it's hard to accept the CGI. And it's probably even harder to accept a human as the Hulk the way the old TV show got away with. I don't think we could get away with that now. That said, there is at least one sequence in this film, maybe two, where the Hulk is used really effectively. I like the battle with the army in the park, but the one I'm really thinking of is the first time we see him.
Yes.
In a warehouse.
Yes.
It's kind of a Jaws effect. Actually made me think of Batman Begins, too, the first time Batman comes out, where you're only seeing quick glimpses of the Hulk or parts of him. He's in shadows, and it really builds up the suspense of what this Hulk is. By the end of the movie, though, Matty, and this will probably come as no surprise to longtime listeners of the show, after the point where we've been assaulted with a solid 20 to 30 minutes of CGI chaos and destructed, yeah, it lost me. It alienated me. I thought the movie became silly after starting out really serious and intelligent. It did lose me, unfortunately, by the end, and the CGI was a large part of it.
You pretty much stole my review. I actually think the old CBS television series was onto something because the least interesting thing about The Incredible Hulk is the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
The most compelling aspect of this saga is watching Bruce Banner forced to wander the world as sort of this itinerant outcast, forever on the run, searching for a cure. In essence, what you have with the Hulk, it's a living room drama.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of Howard's End meets Beauty and the Beast. And I think Leterrier gets it right for the first 20 minutes. As you said, he understands the Hulk is Jaws. He's the shark. It's best to build and to play with the suspense around the actual outburst, not show the outburst itself. So when it's happening in the shadows, we can use our imagination to fill that in. That great scene in the factory where he's picking off the workers
mm-hmm.
one by one, never giving us a real view of what the monster is. We can color that in. Unfortunately, when you bring him out into the light to face the choppers, I actually did not like that scene, you've lost me. And I think you've actually lost most of the audience. And that's what this movie devolves into. It becomes the Hulk versus army helicopters. And I know this criticism is a tad stale, but I think it applies here. You end up with an experience by the end similar to watching a friend play a video game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right to some extent, because the world starts to become really fake. You can see that it's totally fabricated. Nothing about New York at the end of the film feels authentic. But I will give the movie maybe a little bit more credit than you. I actually think it's very good for even more than 20 minutes, maybe 30 or 40. And you know, with an actor like Ed Norton, that he's going to need some kind of intellectual attack point as a screenwriter, as an actor for any movie. But I especially think with a big budget comic book adaptation like this, he's going to need something to sink his teeth into. And the concept they came up with, he along with Leterrier, I'm not sure how to say his name, but that concept of treating Bruce Banner's rage like a substance abuse problem, something where he has to struggle every day to control himself, I actually really dug that. And I think it's interesting because that problem is actually in some ways harder than a drug or alcohol problem, because even seemingly harmless social interactions can get your heart rate up. And the only way to actually avoid having your buttons pushed is to take yourself completely off the grid, live a life of complete solitude, basically. And that's where this movie begins. And it really hooked me in. And the time the movie spends setting all of this up, and Banner's life in Portugal, he's trying to work and stay out of trouble and find ways to control his rage. It's all really good, really interesting stuff. How does someone with this problem function in society? After you Hulk out and you wake up in another country like Guatemala and you have nothing except some oversized pants, how do you start over? Those are really interesting questions that the movie starts by trying to ask and answer, and then it just throws them away.
No, you're exactly right. Those first 20 minutes are great. We're actually in Brazil. And that the camera work that Leterrier incorporates there is so much more mature work than Jon Favreau in Iron Man. And I actually enjoyed this movie as much as I did Iron Man. And I actually thought what I liked best was the depth that Ed Norton brought to this character. Mm-hmm. I actually thought he brought more than Robert Downey Jr. did to Tony Stark. And I think that's a little bit of a criticism of the Tony Stark that I saw in Iron Man. Tony Stark is a playboy with really cool gadgets. I'd love to spend the day with him, but you're absolutely right. I would rather watch a guy who's diseased, who at any moment turns into a menace to society. I would rather watch that story. And I think Ed Norton is onto something there. Unfortunately, he's betrayed, and the whole project is betrayed, by the love story.
That too.
And that script is just terrible. And unfortunately, it's not helped by Liv Tyler. I think Liv Tyler is gorgeous, but unfortunately, she belongs in Aerosmith videos, because that's about the level that she brings to this performance. And it was really sort of gut-wrenching trying to watch those two develop any sort of chemistry while they were on the screen.
Yeah, and there really was, for me, a make-or-break point in the film, a point where I knew the movie was either going to continue down this really interesting, introspective path or bust out and finally Hulk out into the true summer blockbuster monster that it wants to be. And it was when Banner decides, after this opening scene where he's Hulked out for the first time, he's going to have to return home. And he's in Guatemala.
Yeah.
And he has no money, barely any clothes, certainly no official documents of any kind. And I started thinking, is this movie actually going to show us how he gets back to the States? How this broken man actually rebuilds himself?
That's what I wanted.
I wanted it too.
I wanted Bruce Bixby wandering from town to town.
Yeah, exactly. And I was really hoping, could it possibly do it? If it does, it's going to take this movie to a whole new level for me, and I was really going to like it. What happens instead, we get a few non-Banner scenes, and then the next time we see him, he's on campus looking for Betty Ross wearing, you know, a Gap hat or something. They just omitted it completely. And the problem isn't that I didn't believe it, that I didn't buy that he could eventually get back to the States. He made it out of the country somehow the first time. It's that I wanted the movie to continue to be character-driven and not CGI and action-driven. And sure enough, that's what the movie does devolve into. As we said, it actually becomes Hulk meets Cloverfield, with fake monsters destroying New York City. And I know that that is probably the payoff a lot of people going into this movie may want to see, but that kind of spectacle, for me personally, isn't what gets me excited.
Yeah, and this is Zach Penn. Now, it's on him twice this year. He has given me two of the most forgettable screenplays of the year. He also penned The Grand, which I absolutely despised. I brought up this same comment with Iron Man. I have to believe all the storylines at Marvel's disposal. Why did they come up with this generic one with this big amphibious reptile Tim Roth
Abomination.
Character? Yeah, and actually, I do like the way that they build up that sort of villainous parallel much better than they did in Iron Man.
Yes.
Again, but still the payoff is not as good. I wanted what I think Ed Norton probably
yes.
wanted was that psychological delving, you know, the sort of gritting your teeth into this thing and say, what is behind this guy?
Right.
What is lurking there, rather than the big Rampage-esque, you know, showdown at the
exactly.
end.
Exactly. And we know a little bit about Ed Norton. He has a history with some films, American History X and others,
yeah.
being one of these very creative guys who wants to control a lot of aspects of a film. And I had heard that there were some rumblings about how he wasn't happy with the movie, but I hadn't read the Entertainment Weekly article yet before we watched the film. And I tried to just avoid a lot of that stuff because
yeah.
I don't want it in my head clouding my judgment while I'm watching the film. But last night when I was preparing for this review, I did read the article, and it turns out that he and Leterrier were on the same page of this film from the get-go, which I think actually comes through very clearly in a lot of scenes, some of the things we've been discussing. But it is a situation where, apparently, the studio said, we want a leaner, tighter movie. We want to get to the action, cut out some of this character stuff. And
oh.
they took a movie that the original cut, which doesn't to me at all sound egregious, it was 2 hours and 15 minutes. That's the cut Norton and Leterrier wanted. And the studio said, no, we want this shorter 90-minute version. So think about 45 minutes being cut out. I would have loved to see the 2 hour and 50 minute version. I have a future top five idea, Maddie, and that is movies destroyed or at least hurt greatly by studios messing with the scripts. I think the Hulk, the Incredible Hulk, might fall on that list somewhere because I would really love to see that 2 hour and 15 minute version and see if it answered some of the problems we had with it.
Well, here's hoping that for the next installment, and we know that there will be. Actually, Marvel is doing some genius cross-marketing here, and I did like that. I liked the introduction also of the Tim Blake Nelson character
mm-hmm.
at the end. I thought that was really, really nice. He does some really fine acting. And then you have Tim Roth. Basically, it's a gluttony contest between him and William Hurt to see who can chew
right.
the most scenery. But they are having a lot of fun with
it. I think they're actually both fairly subtle. I was shocked. I leaned to you and said that we missed an opportunity with our top five this week, top five hammiest actors
mm-hmm.
in honor of William Hurt. But then the movie started, and he's really restrained, actually.
Well,
he's much more restrained than Sam Elliott, for example, in Ang Lee's Hulk, though the characters are very different for very different
well,
reasons.
They're having a lot of fun with it. They're playing
yeah.
it for what it is, and that's what you have to do.
What did you think of Tim Roth, though? I know you're not as big a fan of his as I am. I actually have to say here, I didn't think he was very good. I didn't think as Blonsky, this badass soldier, it really worked. Every time he tried to deliver a really cool, menacing, badass line, I kind of thought it was funny.
He kind of swallowed it a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, like kind of down like that. But I, all in all, actually, I did think he was pretty good here. And here's hoping for the franchise that they might actually let Mr. Norton write the next one.
That would be
I
great.
I cannot believe I'm actually saying that.
I know.
Here's hoping.
Me neither, especially after the debacle for me that was down in the valley. But I'd like to see him have greater control here. I do want to say one other thing about this film that I did like. Unlike Iron Man, this was a case where it was a comic book movie that I can geek out to. I wasn't that familiar with Iron Man, and I actually didn't read the comics much of The Hulk, but I loved the TV series as a kid. And so when you get the moment where you hear the TV theme song for the first time with Ed Norton walking, just like I remember watching Bruce Bixby walking a lot to that theme music, that was a cool moment for me. And the great close-up shot that you see in a lot of the pictures in the publicity stuff for this film of his eyes changing to green, that's a classic shot from the TV series. I geeked out to that a little bit. There were some great little nods, even the great cameo, the appearance
on
Courtship of
Betty's
father.
And they weren't distracting this time. They weren't distracting.
Right.
They sort of fed the plot a
mm-hmm.
little bit. Actually,
Stan Lee
is involved with the plot for the first time ever.
An effective use of a Stan Lee cameo.
Exactly.
So there certainly are things to recommend about this movie. I really did genuinely love what I'm considering the Midnight Express portion of the film. Unfortunately, it then devolves into the Fantastic Four a little bit.
I think you and I are actually on the same wavelength here.
Okay, well, The Incredible Hulk is out now in theaters everywhere. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly too clear. M. Night Shyamalan messes with our heads next. Stay with us.
I need a broken-hearted girl who wants my time. I need the letter of her law like she needs mine. Inspired and tattooed and about to go blind from waiting. A broken-hearted girl with a dirty mind. knows my way from all over town. A broken-hearted girl who gets around. She begs me to stay, then she changes her mind. 'Cause to a broken-hearted girl, I'm a waste of time.
There appears to be an event happening. It's some kind of attack. The first stage is loss of speech.
Claire? Claire?
The second stage is physical disorientation. The third stage is fatal.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Maddie Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and we just heard, of course, a clip from the trailer for M. Night Shyamalan's new film, The Happening. And Maddie, I just want to verify something with you. We did discuss the final movie in our 70s sci-fi marathon last week, right?
Yes.
The Man Who Fell to Earth, that was the last movie?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, I'm a little confused because this week was supposed to be our break from the sci-fi marathon, and yet here we are discussing The Happening, a movie that I would argue isn't just a sci-fi movie, but one that feels in many ways exactly like a 70s sci-fi movie. It's a cautionary tale. You've got an intriguing, mysterious premise. A toxin of unknown origin and chemistry is sweeping the Northeast and basically reversing our survival instinct. Once exposed, people start offing themselves in ways that vary in creativity from gunshot to the head to run over by lawnmower. And there is plenty of science. Mark Wahlberg actually plays a New York science teacher trying to keep himself and his wife alive while also searching for the explanation behind this horrifying phenomenon. And as with many of the sci-fi movies we watched recently, my complex lab analysis also turned up a fairly high level of camp here, or at least unintentional comedy. So my question for you is, where would The Happening fall in relation to our other 70s sci-fi movies? Up there near Soylent Green and The Man Who Fell to Earth, or down with Logan's Run and, for me, Silent Running, films with brilliant concepts but really poor execution? You're really thinking about this one, Maddie.
You know, no one should actually have to experience acting school, graduate acting school. Basically, it's 3 years of people taking your soul, stomping on it, and building you back up. It's basically boot camp. My favorite instructor, Brian McElhaney, after watching a scene in class, one that, let's just say, didn't work too well, would put his head down for about 30 seconds. He would reach his hand out as though he were grasping at something, grasping at just the words to lacerate what he just saw. And he would say, wow. If there was camp here, then perhaps I could have enjoyed this thing. But I'm going to go on record and say, this is perhaps the worst waste of resources in the history of cinema that I have ever seen. And I have seen Ringmaster, the Jerry Springer movie. This thing, this is not hyperbole, folks, is unwatchable.
It is a disaster. It really is a disaster, and I don't want to rehash everything I said back when I reviewed The Lady in the Water on the show, but with M. Night Shyamalan, he's the ultimate case for me of a director who is giving you diminishing returns. Starting with The Sixth Sense, a movie I really liked, each movie has just gotten progressively worse, culminating with Lady in the Water, which I can't say I hated, but I definitely didn't like.
How does this get greenlighted?
I don't know.
Because it's Shyamalan?
Maybe. Maybe so, but he has had issues with studios recently. And the thing about Shyamalan, though, in his defense, the one thing I've always been able to come to his defense with is that even when I thought he went too far and he got bogged down with this ridiculous group against the world ideology like he did in The Village and Lady in the Water, I still had respect for him as a craftsman. as a filmmaker. I'm not saying he's Martin Scorsese or Ingmar Bergman, but I know I've told this story before about watching the movie Signs, how I remember seeing it in the theater and sort of reveling at his ability as a director to work his audience, to elicit every single response he was going for at any moment. He knew just the right camera movement or edit or use of sound to really unnerve you, get you to jump out of your seat, whatever. This movie, The Happening, is the final step in the de-evolution of M. Night Shyamalan. Yeah. The streams have crossed here. It's not only his most ridiculous, heavy-handed storyline, I mean just pure hokum from start to finish, hokum, but it's also terribly, terribly conceived and executed from start to finish.
The first minute, I was gripped. That was about it. It had me in its grip for the first minute. But you're right. There's absolutely no suspense to this thing.
None.
Whatsoever. The only reason I stayed in the theater was because I wanted to know what The Happening actually was, because my only enjoyment was when people started dying.
Mm-hmm.
And even that wasn't all that interesting.
No.
I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. And actually, this film does suffer from some of the same symptoms that The Hulk does, because like all good disaster flicks, basically you have set up a living room drama against the backdrop of a disaster.
And it's terrible here. Way worse than The Hulk.
It's
the
awful
love story.
It is awful. At least Zooey Deschanel, the love interest, is trying something a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's kind of imperfect. She's kind of human. I kind of dug that. But Mark Wahlberg, and I have a lot of respect for this guy. I really do. It was like watching your nephew's high school performance of John Proctor in The Crucible. I mean, seriously. And that falls on Shyamalan, too. I cannot believe he let him get away with that.
No, he hangs him out to dry, I think, actually, in a lot of scenes, in the way he conceives the scenes and executed him, as I said.
Am I being punked? I'm seriously. Mm. Is Shyamalan coming through the door right now,
maybe,
this whole thing?
Maybe. He could be any minute. We'll keep an eye out. It could have a twist ending to this review, Maddie. But I'm with you about Wahlberg, who is an actor I've always gone kind of hot and cold with. And here, I was really cold on him. Basically, think about Boogie Nights, the scene where his mom's yelling at him and he's like, don't say that. Don't call me that.
Right.
That's the kind of whiny he is here almost throughout the entire film. And he really did drive me nuts. And I just want to say, the crew is first rate. Tak Fujimoto, the cinematographer, has photographed some great films. Conrad Buff, the editor, I have no doubt these guys know exactly what they're doing, which is why I do have to put the blame back on Shyamalan. All of the awkwardness, the stiff dialogue, the awful cliched close-ups, the unintentional comedy that does come up, that's the way Shyamalan clearly envisioned
that
this film.
That shot in the zoo?
I know.
Can you believe that?
That's finally where I burst out in laughter.
That's when I thought, okay, all right, I'm not getting this. I see. It's a joke. I see. This is all tongue-in-cheek, right?
Right, right. It's easily his worst film. And it is the worst film I've seen all year. And I just briefly had to see. You're right. You're wondering if you got punked or not. I went over to Metacritic today. And at this time of our recording the show, there were only three comments up there. And one of them was Robert Wolanski. And he was mixed on the movie, actually. He didn't just all out hate it. He was mixed on it. And he actually said this, Maddie. What a bunch of nonsense. Effective nonsense. Chilling nonsense. Occasionally wrenching nonsense. But nonsense nonetheless. And
when?
He even goes on to say,
when?
The film's first 10 minutes are, down to the last second, unrelentingly horrific. No, they're not. I actually think most of those 10 minutes are kind of hilarious. And I just have to say that it is truly nonsense, but it's never chilling. It's never wrenching.
No.
It never had me on the edge of my seat. It never had me even squirming in my seat, despite its best efforts. And it never had me fearing for the lives of these main characters. I think that Shyamalan has finally got to a point where he's so interested in being clever and trying to present this whole us against the world viewpoint. We should all be afraid. The outside world is scary. Everything's a threat. He's so consumed with that that he's lost his ability to simply entertain an audience. It truly is pretentious in the grandest sense of the word, because I think it's a director taking himself and his material way too seriously. I mean, it had me longing for George Romero and watching Diary of the Dead, because at least you have a director who's making serious points but also knows that he's making a zombie movie and can laugh at himself a little bit. Shyamalan can't laugh at himself.
He's giving us the inconvenient movie.
Yeah.
You know, and then you drag down Betty Buckley, too.
Right.
My God, the diva's diva. She's doing this sort of Lillian Gish from Night of the Hunter routine. I mean, this movie goes from the bizarre to the absolutely absurd, and unfortunately, never in an entertaining way. It's never campy enough for me to say, hey, have a couple beers, go out, watch this thing, and laugh along with it. It's just dreadfully bad, and I think you hit it on the head. I don't think Shyamalan is half as talented or half as smart or half as clever as he thinks he is.
Maybe not. And again, that's so disappointing for me because you watch those films, Unbreakable even, The Sixth Sense, even the movies I didn't like The Village and Lady in the Water, those movies I thought at least were well-crafted. I felt like he knew what he was going for, whether I bought it or thought it worked or not. He really knew what he was doing. He knew how to manipulate his audience with the camera and narratively. And here he's just completely lost it. I really think he has. And you're right about Wahlberg. Deschanel is average, but really I blame that on Shyamalan. The only performance I actually liked in the movie, and he's not in it for too long, is Leguizamo as his friend.
He's okay.
As his friend, this math teacher. I mean, he's got terrible dialogue to say, yeah. Don't get me wrong, but I really bought him in the role. I thought he was good.
You know who I liked? I liked Frank Collison as the nursery owner.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a sort of weirdo. I mean, and basically, that's what it boiled down to. By that point in the movie, I was just grasping at anything to hold on to.
Yeah.
And at least he gave me that. He gave me this edge of, okay, there's something not right happening here,
mm-hmm.
You know, pardon the pun. And, you know, there is the germ of an idea of something good.
No pun intended.
Yeah, exactly. Of something good here, but he just makes a complete and utter mess of it.
No, you're right. It's a hodgepodge of all these recent post 9/11 virus zombie movies. Of course, 28 Weeks Later is ripped off here, right down to the terrible ending of this film, The Invasion. I even did think of Logan's Run again to bring back our 70 sci-fi marathon because you've got this horrible love story thrown
into the narrative.
Please
tell me you would not have loved if Peter Ustinov would have not have just shown up and just started spouting nonsense.
You're
and
right.
You kind of get that a little bit actually with Betty Buckley.
Betty Buckley, you're right. It's almost a Ustinov-esque performance.
Right, but not self-aware enough.
You're
not
right.
Self-aware
here
enough.
I actually wanted Ustinov to show up. You're absolutely right. And actually, the best way I can describe this movie, because I'm talking about how much I hated the way it was shot and just conceived and visualized in just about every moment, and that's why there's no suspense to it. The opening scenes, they're not suspenseful because they're so clunky. The best way I can describe it is it's a thriller if Wes Anderson was directing it.
Ooh.
And I like Wes Anderson. Don't get me wrong. That's not my point. I'm not trying to bring him down. But imagine Wes Anderson with his blocky, absurdist style of filmmaking trying to make a thriller. It would be a disaster, and it's a disaster here. I do not know what got into Shyamalan, but I'm not defending him anymore. It's officially over. The relationship's ended.
God, it's like, you know, it's like your best friends have been trying to tell you that for about
know,
2 years.
I keep trying.
She's not the girl for you.
I know. And I just keep trying to say, no, he'll get it back. He'll get it back. But I think he's lost it for good here, unfortunately. The Happening is out now in wide release. If you see it, we're sorry if you do. And agree or
maybe
disagree
you
with
need
our
the
takes.
Air conditioning. I don't know.
Yeah. Email feedback at filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463. And Maddie, it's actually interesting. I think we'll actually end up moving people to see the film just to see how bad it is.
No, don't. Seriously, listen to me. It's not that bad.
Go in there.
It's not that bad. All right, well, time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater and female listeners turn out to bury Carrie Bradshaw, not to praise her. Stay with us.
You've seen him go liquid so many times. When his coat drags on the ground, it shines. Oh, you know he's been sleeping in his clothes, and then nobody else knows. Says he wishes he could tell the whole world when he's got you alone. He says you bring a raise to his pride. He still feels the need to hide away your love. He says you bring a raise to his pride, but he still feels obliged to hide. Oh, when you go, your heart goes silently with you alone. Oh, when you go, your heart goes silent.
Must be some way of scaring them off, driving them out, of getting rid of every human being alive. It's down the hall and to the left.
No, sir.
What?
Sir.
What?
I got it.
You do? What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. I'm Maddie. He's Adam. It's time now for Massacre Theater, everybody's favorite part of the show, wherein Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a free DVD of your choice. Now, last week, we massacred the scene you just heard between Slim Pickens and Harvey Korman, the late Harvey Korman, from Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles. We wanted to pay a little tribute to Mr. Korman, who passed away just a few weeks ago at the age of 81.
That's right. So we've had two tributes in a row here, Harvey Korman, Sidney Pollack. We did wonder if we're setting a trend where every time an actor or a filmmaker dies, we're expected to pay tribute. But Harvey Korman absolutely deserved it.
Yeah, exactly. In the vein of Dean Martin, basically, he was the world's best straight man. His work on the Carol Burnett Show, glorious.
Yeah, and Jeff Houston, one of our listeners in Tulsa, Oklahoma, said it really well. He said the guy was a comedic genius. While he did enjoy success on the Carol Burnett Show and a few films, it's a true shame that his career wasn't bigger than it was. Most people might say that simply because Harvey Korman was good but not great, or that his talents were too limited. I would argue the opposite, that the industry's talents were too limited to fully capitalize on all that Harvey Korman had to offer. Very well put, Jeff. It was, Maddie, even though you cried tough last week and tried to suggest that listeners would not know this one, even though it's one of the most quotable movies of all time, Blazing Saddles, it is now the third most entered massacre theater of all time, just ahead of Tootsie.
Wow.
Yeah, it is. And also, we have to point out that last week on the show, we said Rock Creek. A lot of listeners know this movie well, know that it's really Rock Ridge. We were trying to throw a wrench in there a little bit,
right,
make it a little harder. So there you have it.
All right, Animal, why don't you reach into that film spotting hat and pull out this week's winner.
And the winner is Chris Vicroy from Iowa City, Iowa.
I know exactly where that is.
Yes, I was just there last weekend. Glorious place. Congratulations. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, Chris, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and I'm not sure why we even bother saying this anymore, but we really did try to make it harder this week. We're not going to tell you what the tie-in is, but following up Tootsie and Blazing Saddles, we are trying to make it a little harder, a little bit more of a challenge. Maddie, I started off. You're going to give me the action.
And action!
Let's test it for the record. Will the next victim be a man or a woman?
A woman.
What color hair will she have?
Blonde.
Tell me some other things about her.
She's in high school. She's sexually active. She's on drugs. She's crying out for some help.
You're describing half the high school girls in America. What is she doing right now?
She's preparing a great abundance of food.
And scene. Nicely played, Maddie Ballgame. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback at filmspotting.net. You have until Wednesday, June 18th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
I can't believe I was running around New York thinking I'm finally getting my happy ending. And let the wedding get bigger than big. Have you ever been a personal assistant?
No.
Why'd you move to New York?
To fall in love.
Clip there, of course, from Sex in the City, and we're going to get into some great Sex in the City feedback here in a moment, but I do have a couple of quick notes to mention, Maddie. First of all, I want to give a quick shout-out, if I may, to my brother-in-law, the brother I never had, Sean Hoy, who is listening to the show, I'm sure, in Boston. Happy birthday to him. He's actually the same age as you, Maddie.
25?
Yes,
nice.
Exactly. He just turned 25. I'm sure he loves hearing that. Also, Maddie's Movie Minute. The listeners are clamoring. They want to know when the next one's happening. Maddie, when can you promise another Maddie's Movie Minute?
I'm telling you, we've had a really hectic schedule here. We just finished up a great class at the University of Chicago.
We
had a lot of fun with that. But it looks like next week I got a little something lined up. Sheila from accounting might be taking the old Maddie out on the town.
Okay, I look forward to that. And you did, actually, in your defense. You tried to go see Zohan, but you screwed it up and went to the wrong theater.
I did.
You did.
I did. I hope Sheila's not listening.
Okay. Well, look forward to Maddie's Movie Minute, hopefully next week. I also just wanted to briefly mention, I will be in lovely Ottawa, Canada next week. I want to hear from some of our Ottawa listeners. What are the sights and sounds of Ottawa? What do I need to check out? You can email feedback at filmspotting.net.
Doesn't Jim Carrey just stand out on the sidewalk waving?
Maybe. Maybe so. He should.
In my dreams.
Along with Bryan Adams.
Is he an Ottawan?
I don't know. He's just Canadian, and I'm lumping them all together like an ignorant American.
You are terrible.
Yeah, I am. Okay, well, let's get into the mailbag, Maddie. Of course, Sex and the City, we reviewed it a couple weeks ago on the show. A fairly contentious debate, actually, with our guest critic, Jessica Reeves, who really loved the movie. I really hated the movie. You were somewhere in the middle there. We did get a few people who liked the movie. Michelle here from San Jose.
During the movie, I thought about the parallels between the girls on screen and my girlfriend sitting next to me. One, 10-plus-year boyfriend, no wedding or kid plans. One, married, two kids, career track, wondering what's next. And me, happily married with two daughters, one bio and one adopted, hopefully without Charlotte's hang-ups. We are the women on the screen, minus the haute couture, glam apartments, and Vanity Fair spreads, of course. As Carrie says in the open, what happens after the wedding? The reality. Few movies care. Thank you, Sex and the City. Take that, Adam.
Okay, Michelle from San Jose there. We do appreciate it. Doug Skinner in Newfield, New Jersey was on the same page. He writes, I'm a late 20s male who doesn't drink, has no fashion sense, or any money to enjoy the posh lifestyle of these ladies. But I thought this movie worked. Sure, I've seen some of the TV show, particularly the final episode. I'm a final episode TV junkie. And while I can't say I was a super fan, I always thought it was clever. To the movie, I offer much the same, clever and witty. I think Kristen Davis was the highlight of the film. Terrific job. I liked her as well. I've always admired Chris Noth for finding a character that just sort of has to be there and not do much. He basically had three lines the whole movie. In the end, I just wanted to be in the theater, and this seemed like the only movie worth seeing, and it proved to be more than worth it, good even. Adam, you're wrong on this one. Unfortunately for Doug, most of our listeners, Maddie, those really were two of about three comments from listeners who liked this movie. Many more of them felt like Nikki here.
From Vegas writing in, I heart Sex and the City, but Adam, I agree with you. I wanted an epic romance, joy, angst, joy again. I wanted a movie, not a bunch of TV episodes, badly structured TV episodes. The show was a tightly compressed half-hour-ish show, and the movie was several episodes with a lot of filler. I saw the pre-screening of this movie, and please understand, I love Sex and the City. The shoes, the girls, the handbags, the girls. I stood in line for over 2 hours to end up sitting three rows from the screen. I spent a half hour watching nausea-inducing camera work while Sarah Jessica, Kristen Kim, and Jennifer Hudson walked the red carpet. We did too,
we
Nikki.
Did.
Then the movie began. At the 10-minute mark, things went terribly, horribly wrong and stayed that way. Shame on you, Michael Patrick King, for trying to cram two seasons worth of story arc and angst into an hour and a half. Shame on you, New Line Cinema, for allowing that cut of your film to leave the studio. And lastly, and most importantly, shame on me. Why? For being the kind of loyal girl who drops $20 on a movie just because I'm invested in the characters. For being the kind of person who can't wait for the movie to come out on DVD and on the off chance that I might later regret not seeing it on the big screen. For buying into the hype. But mostly, for being sad that the movie sucked. It's like Big broke my heart tonight. I don't think I'll ever be the same. That's Nikki in Vegas, age 34, and yes, I own all the SATC DVDs, and I will be spending the weekend watching the entire series again. Thank you very much.
I appreciate the support there, Nikki. Very well done, and I hope you had more fun watching the DVDs there. Again, Amy Lopez from Maui with this one. I made sure to see Sex and the City before listening to your review, and I have to say, I agree with Adam. I, a woman and a huge fan of the show, hated this movie. I loved the fashion, but felt as if they were using it as a crutch to disguise the fact that nothing else was happening in the scene. I felt like the same actresses were cast to portray parodies of the original characters, as these characters seemed to lack dimension in the movie. I really didn't like some of the characters. The poor men hardly had any screen time, Samantha was not in any way lively or exciting or someone I wanted to spend time with, and Mr. Big still had the same one-note charm that he had in the show. Why should I root for that? I really do feel like Chris Noth was completely phoning it in and wasted in this movie, so I'm with Amy there. There were moments I did enjoy, like Charlotte messing herself up in Mexico, but otherwise, this was a ridiculously long episode that I couldn't pause on my TiVo and come back to in a few hours or days.
Yeah, unfortunately, the last half of that movie really felt like that for me. It sort of felt like, you know, a very special Brady, you know, trip.
Right.
We're going to go to Hawaii for two episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And here, a 50-something woman in Florida chimes in. I like this email. SATC was a huge disappointment. The script was abominable. Women come to New York looking for love and labels? Huh? Anthony and Stanford, a couple? What? Fart and pube jokes? Is this a Judd Apatow movie? The direction shoddy, and worst of all, the characters not only betrayed one another, they betrayed themselves and their audience. The only one who didn't cause me to cringe, not even once, was Chris Noth.
Wow.
Who, even though he seemed to be trying to figure out what the hell he was supposed to be doing,
yes,
he sort of lit up the screen. I actually agree with her. I'm sorry I saw it. The last episode was 100 times better.
Well, some interesting thoughts there. And again, this wasn't just selective picking by me. Really, there were, I think, 3 positive responses to Sex and the City in our entire mailbag. We do appreciate all the feedback we got. And I was also really surprised a little bit, Maddie, at some of the just general responses to Sex and the City we got. And I just want to share a few brief comments here. I'm not a person who has spent a lot of time thinking about what Sex and the City really means or the larger kind of cultural perspective on it, but Anna Zemanski in Brooklyn wrote in just tearing apart Sex and the City, saying, criticizing this movie does not make one sexist because this film, like the show, is itself sexist. These women are portrayed as whiny, narcissistic, materialistic twits. If I act like them when I'm 35 or 45, I think I may shoot myself. And Kelsey in Rockville, Maryland wrote, watching my friends idolize the fashion-obsessed, Cosmo-drinking gossips of the show made me want to pull my hair out. The idea that such a show could really take off is beyond me. These aren't women. These are Barbie dolls with severe relationship issues. How am I supposed to relate to them? All I ask for is a return of the romantic comedy with real characters, real women, with real personalities. Is she asking for too much there, Matt?
Well, I actually think it's a little bit unfair because I don't think these are pot shots at the movie. This sounds like these women have been saving up ammunition from the television
Absolutely
series.
Right.
And I haven't seen the television series. I'm not really going to criticize it. I mean, it's certainly a cultural zeitgeist. Everybody from Bill O'Reilly to Lauren Hutton has been weighing in on this. I don't feel that qualified to do so. I can only respond to the movie that I saw. I didn't see that. I didn't see the Barbie dolls. I saw the relationships there. It did touch me on some level.
I admire your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Who wants him?
James Bond, Universal Exports.
What's your name?
James.
And with that clip, of course, from James Bond, Sean Connery as James Bond, we transition into a little bit of our top 5 best-dressed characters feedback. It was a tie-in with our review of Sex and the City. Going to start with this one, Sophie in Sydney, Australia.
She writes in, number 5, James Bond. What, not even an honorable mention for the action hero defined by Savile Row? For shame, boys, for shame. Number 4, Queen Elizabeth II, Helen Mirren. I admit this one breaks some rules. She's a queen and is wearing the modern costume of a queen. It's not fashionable, nor normal person would ever wear her clothes. I think we went on record as saying the queen was not going to make our list.
Right.
Number 3, Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford. A hat for the sun, a gun for the Nazis, and a whip for just about everything else. Everything an adventuring archaeologist needs for the field. It's not just the iconic silhouette, it's that he never looks comfortable in anything else. Very, very nicely put. Number 2, Vianne, Juliette Binoche in Chocolat. I came out of this movie with 2 things, a crush on Johnny Depp and a sketch of Vianne's blue suit on the pier and her red hooded cape and her nightgown.
And her shoes.
I honestly, I saw that film. I don't remember a thing about what Juliette Binoche wore.
No.
Number 1, Sabrina, Audrey Hepburn. While Breakfast at Tiffany's and Roman Holiday have had more influence on fashion, they are both very much costumes for characters pretending to be someone else. In Sabrina, she develops into a woman who can wear Givenchy and doesn't need to ask, how do I look?
All great choices. Obviously, Audrey Hepburn was our number 1 picks. And I just want to clarify something she said about Queen Elizabeth II. She acknowledges, of course, that it breaks the rules, but Sophie did say that for a situation where the person is indistinguishable from her position, I think the queen always looks perfectly appropriate for her role and the occasion, and Mirren hit it for 6. I think she's absolutely right there. Let's go to this one from Eli Bard in New York City.
I love those hats.
I know. How could you leave out any of the James Bonds, especially Connery? What about Rick from Casablanca? Of course, Casablanca is in our pantheon, but Eli says it should have been the Rick Blaine Memorial List. And the worst omission, Richard Gere in American Gigolo,
nice.
The movie that put
Very
Armani
nice.
On the movie fashion map. Very good point on all of those, actually. And Will Sparks in Aspen, Colorado pointed out that I had Elliot Ness, Kevin Costner from The Untouchables on my list, and Will notes that the wardrobe in The Untouchables was actually designed by Giorgio Armani, and he agrees that the suits were spectacular.
All right, well, Curtis Jensen from San Francisco, California writes in, I have no real quibbles with your choices, especially Audrey Hepburn. I would add Jennifer Lopez in Out of Sight, the best-dressed federal marshal ever. Her clothing and style are integral to the plot. Richard Gere in American Gigolo. In fact, Christian Bale's character in American Psycho is merely echoing, buying into the groundbreaking and trendsetting men's fashion styles from this early 80s film. Eleanor Parker in The Sound of Music, a glamorous foil to Julie Andrews' frumpy Maria. Every outfit is the definition of sophisticated chic, perfect tailoring, impeccable style. the cast of the women, Sex and the City, circa 1939, with high fashion and consumerism taking as central a place in their lives as it is for Carrie Bradshaw and company, and, number one, Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada. Perhaps a bit obvious, but perfectly costumed high fashion and probably more wardrobe changes than any film ever.
Well done there, Curtis. Two quick comments as we close here, Maddie. Jared from Dorchester, his number one, Rosemary's Baby. Mia Farrow is like an adorable little doll in this movie. That is a very good pick. And also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention at least one email, because we got many of them, and maybe we'll get into this on our After Hours extra podcast edition next week, but Chris Reichert from Tallahassee, Florida, was one of the people who wrote in and mentioned Maggie Cheung's character in the Wong Kar-wai film In the Mood for Love. I completely forgot about it, but just amazing stuff. And you could put Tony Leung, his role as her sort of love interest in that film, up there as well from the best dressed character. So good catch there by our listeners. As always, thanks for the great feedback. Please email any other comments or suggestions to feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, we'll dive into some of your thoughts on Kung Fu Panda, Sydney Pollack's best movies, and hopefully our top five characters who need a comeback.
All right, time for one last quick break. When we return, hear Adam extol the virtues of Josie and the Pussycats, while I wax rhapsodic about Freddie Prinze Jr.'s turn in the venerable Scooby-Doo. Our top five television adaptations are up next. Stay with us. Just might get a half right. Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD this week, brought to you by TLAvideo.com, the world of film at your fingertips.
Coming out this Tuesday, Maddie, a movie we both really like from last year, the Romanian film 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. Unfortunately, doesn't seem to be loaded with any extras, but that is out now and worth seeing. Just prepare yourself for it. It's not an easy sit. Also out, Be Kind, Rewind. It does include a making-of featurette. This is the Michel Gondry film I was kind of mixed on. I think you were too, if I recall.
Oh, I enjoyed it pretty well. I think it'd make a good rental.
It'd make a good rental, absolutely. Also, Joy Division, the documentary Joy Division, this on the heels of Control, which just came out either last week or the week before. We both recommended Control. We saw it at the Toronto Film Festival. I think we both saw Joy Division, the documentary, there as well. I remember liking it more than you did.
I didn't have enough Ian Curtis for me.
That's true.
I never got it quite right. It's like Goldilocks.
Well, he is dead, so you only have the footage to go on. But it's kind of the answer to Control in a lot of ways. That movie only focuses on Ian Curtis. And here with Joy Division, the documentary, you really get the other side of the story, I think, and get to look at the band as well as kind of the story of their upbringing in Manchester. So Joy Division is out now. All three movies really worth checking out on DVD, at least, I would say. And you can buy all the DVDs we mentioned here in the segment through TLAvideo.com. Just visit the Film Spotting Movie Store link at filmspotting.net. And actually, Maddie, I want to mention that that does conclude our partnership with TLAvideo.com. We thank them for their support of the show and this relationship. If you're interested in sponsoring the new DVD segment of Film Spotting, go ahead and email feedback@filmspotting.net. We also want to mention our contest that's going on now over at Spout.com. And really, I've seen some of the entries so far in this contest, Scarred for Life, and they're a lot of fun. Go to filmgaming.spout.com now, and in less than 200 words, share the movie experience that scarred you for life. Using the powers of subjectivity, Spout's going to pick the person with the most scarring movie experience to win some swanky Spout swag. You have until Wednesday, June 18th to enter. So go to filmgaming.spout.com and expunge some of those traumatic cinematic memories.
All right. Well, it's time now to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, Adam and I truly are humbled by each and every donation, and it goes a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. So thank you, thank you, thank you to Carly from beautiful Marion, Iowa, Jeff in Sunnyside, New York, Joe in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia.
We are huge
in Melbourne. Mark in Chicago, Chris in the great college town of Austin, Texas, Heather in the gateway to the West, St. Louis, Missouri, and our Silver Club donors, Michael in La Honda, California, and Carrie in the city across from San Francisco, beautiful, blue-collar, bustling, Oakland, one of my favorite cities on the planet. I wish that I could compose a Nipsey Russell poem for each and every single one of you, but instead, remember that for every $10 that you do donate, your name is entered into the Film Spotting hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name, and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab at the top of the page.
Or if we're not going to announce the winner every month, every 5 or 6 weeks or so, we do appreciate all the donations, and we will announce it on that next edition of After Hours, which we promise to have next week, including our listener's choice review of the Robert Wise film from the early 60s, The Haunting. So look forward to that. I live my nights high like a rocket. Stranger tells me I should stop it.
Hey, Maddie, Adam, it's Jay from Lansing, Michigan. Just thought if you guys are going to take a week off before giving out your awards, and we got these great titles for the awards, you know, might want to give us, the audience, you know, a little say in it, because, you know, as much as the Damn Dirty Apes is a fine, fine award I would gladly accept on my own behalf, I do believe your marathon was a 70s marathon. If I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure Planet of the Apes came out in 68. I could be wrong, but I'm heavily leaning towards the carousels, and because it's something I would have never thought up, and I find it rather ingenious.
You are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. And Maddie, we had a comment there from Jay in Lansing, Michigan. He wants to know why we didn't open up the name of our 70s Sci-Fi Marathon Awards to our listeners. We mentioned a couple suggestions last week, the Damn Dirty Apes, the Carousels. We're, of course, going to get into these on next week's show. And actually, my response to Jay is, that's why we threw it out there last week. We're waiting for any other good suggestions. We have not set this in stone yet. If you've got a thought, please share it.
What about the Damn Dirty Drones?
Referencing Silent Running as well. I like that. And Jay, of course we noted that Planet of the Apes is actually from the late 60s, but with Heston being in our marathon twice and the sci-fi connection, we thought it worked anyway. And this is a perfect time, Maddie, to actually mention our next marathon starting in a couple weeks when we finally close out this sci-fi marathon. We are going to get into our next one. It is our classic heist movies marathon. We already said a few shows ago that we have three movies of the six locked in: Rififi, Le Cercle Rouge, and the original Italian Job. We have decided, more or less, on the final three slots, and we're going with The Lavender Hill Mob, The Killing, the Stanley Kubrick film from the 50s, which I've seen but is a classic and a must-see. We're going to watch that one. And then we disagree. We can't decide which Steve McQueen movie we should include in this marathon, The Getaway or The Thomas Crown Affair. So we're actually asking you to decide. Go to filmspotting.net, make your voice heard, tell us which Steve McQueen movie should be included.
Do you want to see The Getaway with Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw?
Sam Peckinpah.
Or do you want to see The Thomas Crown Affair with Steve McQueen and your girl, Faye Dunaway?
You know that's why I'm leaning towards The Thomas Crown Affair. I really do want to check it out. Maddie is firmly entrenched in The Getaway camp. You're going to get to decide it, so go to filmspotting.net and please vote. We also want to share our poll results from last week's show. It ties in with our top five list from last week. We were paying tribute to the actor and director Sidney Pollack, and we asked you what your favorite Sidney Pollack role was. The choices were ethically challenged agent, Tootsie, ethically challenged husband, husbands and wives, ethically challenged lawyer, Michael Clayton, Changing Lanes, The Player, or ethically challenged power broker, Eyes Wide Shut. I think I made the mistake last week of calling him a doctor in Eyes Wide Shut. Tom Cruise's character is the doctor, but we did fix it there on the poll question. So, Maddie, how did it come out? Not a big surprise here, I think.
We love Sidney Pollack in the courtroom, ethically challenged lawyer, at 38% is number one. Number two, ethically challenged agent, Tootsie, at 29%. Ethically challenged husband, husbands and wives, a little bit of a shock here, down at 17%. And ethically challenged power broker, down at 16%. We like our Sidney Pollack a little bit more cute and cuddly than the Eyes Wide Shut version.
Yeah, maybe so. Okay, we do appreciate all of your thoughts in the poll. Thanks to everyone who voted. And now it's top five time this week. It does relate to our review of The Incredible Hulk. A lot of people wrote in, we solicited ideas, and many people did say, why not do a TV show adaptations? Cases like The Hulk, which was a popular TV show, and then now we have seen at least two versions, obviously, of it on the big screen. And we were a little hesitant because there aren't a lot of great choices to pick from, and also in connection with the Hulk, that's really a comic book mm-hmm. adaptation very clearly. But as I touched on during our review, Maddie, this is a case where they owe a lot to that original TV series. They clearly pay tribute to the TV series. So we decided to go with it. What is your number five TV show that transitioned to the big screen?
Well, first, I just want to get out of the way. I only had one rule for this, and that was no movies based on a Saturday Night Live character.
Okay.
Because I pretty much think that could be a list in and of itself.
Yeah, it could.
So my number five, why don't we go ahead and hear a clip?
You could have a great career, and you should.
Yes, you should.
Only one thing stops you, dear. You're too good.
Too damn good.
If you want a future, darling, why don't you get a past?
I'll confess, I actually had no idea that this 1981 film was based on a BBC television series until I started researching for this list. That was Pennies from Heaven. A huge flop when it was released. Steve Martin, Depression-era drama. They sing along with familiar show tunes, but it features the extraordinary Bernadette Peters. I absolutely love her. But of course, it's probably remembered best for the Chris Walken dance scene, mm-hmm. which is great. You can check it out online at certain places.
Okay, well, a great pick there. And like you, I also left out SNL adaptations, if you will. I also did leave out comic book adaptations, like we said with the Hulk. So a movie like Batman is referencing, obviously, the original material, not so much the TV show.
But what would have qualified was the film version of the 1960s television series with Adam West and Burt Ward, but I would be surprised if it makes our list.
If I have even seen it, which I have not. Well, let's get to my number five and hear a clip.
I didn't kill my wife! I don't care!
Of course, the most famous bit of dialogue in that movie, a good Chicago film. My number five is going to be The Fugitive. I just think it's a well-made, fun Hollywood thriller. I love Harrison Ford in it. I love Tommy Lee Jones in it. And an interesting bit of trivia, Maddie, that I found online. Richard Jordan, our friend Francis from Logan's Run, he was replaced on this film by the Dutch actor and director Joran Crabb as Kimball's supposed best friend, the guy who's the other doctor. And I just think it's really interesting that he's basically a Dutch-looking version of Richard Jordan. They really did find someone to exactly replace him. The Fugitive is my number five.
All right, well, my number four, going back to Chicago as well, it is The Untouchables. He sends one of yours to the hospital. What do you do, Adam?
Send him to the morgue.
Absolutely. Absolutely no historical basis for this film whatsoever, but the television series is a lot of fun. Of course, you got the mammoth dialogue. And this movie makes my list because it features, of course, my favorite city and also a period of time that really, really fascinates me. I don't mean to romanticize it or glorify it, but I have annoyed many a date here in Chicago by pointing out the site of one or another gangland slaying.
And actually, we have right now in Chicago the filming of the Michael Mann movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah,
all the 1930s stuff is out
it's
there, all the
fun
gangster stuff. It's kind of neat to see when it's not ruining everyone's commute because of the traffic delays. My number four pick, Maddie, hey, look, it's Enrico Palazzo. I'm sorry. I'm going with The Naked Gun, Files from Police Squad. And I do just have to quote one scene from it, Maddie, and this is just for you because I do love it so much. And really, what can you say about The Naked Gun other than there's hilarious dialogue in it? This is Frank Drebin and the mayor. Now, Drebin, I don't want any trouble like you had on the South Side like last year. That's my policy. Frank, well, when I see five weirdos dressed in togas stabbing a man in the middle of the park in front of a full view of 100 people, I shoot the bastards. That's my policy. That was a Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar, you moron. You killed five actors. Good ones. Great stuff there from The Naked Gun, my number four.
Well, I will see your naked gun, and I will raise you South Park the movie. What we both wanted from Sex and the City, South Park delivered. It was an event. When South Park is on its game, I really believe it is the best, most rapier satire in the country. The audacity of this movie is only outdone by its genius.
Mm-hmm.
And the parody of the musical genres are just brilliant. And it's because those songs could stand alone on their own. So that's why they're terrific.
Yeah, it really is a good choice and a good movie. For me, you know, the only thing that wore me out with South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut was the Saddam Hussein, Satan stuff.
Yeah.
That stuff just really wasn't funny to me by the end of the movie. But you're right. I mean, there's just some brilliant moments in that movie. My number three, I can't do the theme song, unfortunately. I'd love to whistle it right now, but I'm going with Star Trek the Motion Picture. 1979, the Robert Wise film, the director, of course, of the Andromeda Strain. I was such a Trekkie as a kid. I remember watching this on TV with my dad. Maybe it was HBO in the 80s. I don't know, but I watched this movie a lot growing up. And I also like The Wrath of Khan, and I like The Search for Spock. It's good, but all the stories from the sequels to me kind of feel like they could be constrained to TV show episodes or maybe a couple of episodes. But there is some heavy stuff in Star Trek The Motion Picture, so heavy that I can't even really begin to describe it, do the plot any justice. But I will just say that if you haven't seen it, if you're like, hey, I'm not a Trekkie, those are a bunch of geeks, whatever, I say check it out. It's a really good, smart, sci-fi mind-bender of a movie.
Well, it's funny because when I was making my list, I actually put Star Trek on my list, and then I realized I've never seen it. I've never seen the original. I've seen Khan. I've seen The Voyage Home. I've seen Search for Spock. I love all those films, but I've never seen the original.
It feels very different, as I said, to some of those others, and it's really good.
All right. Well, my number two, again, I had no idea this was based on a television series until I went to make my list, and that is Traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Soderbergh really proves here he is the actor's director. Not only just the acting, the cuts, the way he is able to breathe so much life into so many disparate storylines. We only spend about 6 minutes with one character, then we jump over. The achievement here is terrific. It's one of those films I can watch just for the acting alone over and over and over again.
Yeah, and actually, Maddie, it's my number two as well. And the only reason it's not number one is that you could quibble with it being not a TV show, but a TV miniseries, Traffic with a K, the British serial from 1989. Obviously, the characters and the settings are different, but the same basic storylines are there, the interwoven plots. I love just about every performance, as you do, very well said, in the movie Traffic. And as I said when I reviewed the movie at the time, I think Soderbergh really makes his point without resorting to melodrama or moralizing at all. And also, it's an amazingly shot film by Soderbergh himself. Great stuff. My number two.
All right. Well, for my number one, let's go ahead and hear a clip.
Are you suggesting that I killed my wife? You saying that I crushed her skull and that I shot her? How dare you? When I came home, there was a man in my house. I fought with this man. He had a mechanical arm.
You're number five, my number one, The Fugitive. For me, quite possibly the perfect movie. It just sings along. Everyone brings their A-game. Eminently quotable, and purportedly, Alec Baldwin turned down the role of Dr. Richard Kimball.
Hmm.
This is the only film, well, no, it's not the only film, but one of those. If I catch it on TV at any point, I'm watching the whole thing.
Yeah,
it's
a tough
hooked one.
Yeah, that's a good top five list, too, listeners have suggested we may have to do at some point. The movies just grab you, and you can't stop watching. Okay, my number one pick, it has not been mentioned yet, Maddie, not making your list. Let's hear a scene from it.
Do you even know why they sent you?
It's not my place to ask. I believe in something greater than myself. A better world. A world without sin.
So me and mine gotta lay down and die so you can live in your better world?
I'm not going to live there. There's no place for me there, any more than there is for you. Malcolm, I'm a monster.
And that is, of course, Joss Whedon's Serenity. I completely missed the TV series Firefly when it was on. I think I watched a few episodes on DVD to prepare myself to review the movie, but the whole cast is great, especially a man crush of mine, Nathan Fillion, as Captain Malcolm Reynolds, and you heard Chiwetel Ejiofor in the scene with him as the main bad guy. He's awesome. Great, great Joss Whedon dialogue and characters. And for me, the reason it's my number one is that it really got the TV-to-screen adaptation right, and that it has everything there to make fans of the TV show happy, but it doesn't waste time bringing people up to speed with lame montages or relying on knowing the TV show. You don't have to know the show to enjoy it. It stands completely on its own, separate from the TV show. It's a great film, and you're looking at me very confused. I know you haven't seen it. You got to check out Serenity. It's fantastic.
I didn't even know it was a movie.
Are you seriously serious?
When you just dropped that bomb on me right now, I'm racking my brain trying to think of when did this come out?
It came out 2005, I believe, actually. Sam and I reviewed it here on the show. At the time, I'm not going to make fun of you, Maddie, because the fact is, in 2005 when the movie came out, I had no idea what Serenity or Firefly was. None at all. But I knew the movie was coming out. I knew a lot of our listeners were big fans of it.
Is it like an X-Files thing? Or?
A little bit. No, not really at all. But it was on Fox, I believe, and it's science fiction. It takes place in space.
Oh, okay.
But it's really a fantastic TV series, and the movie is great as well. I really think you dig the movie, actually. So check it out.
Okay, well, I do want to give a quick honorable mention to Jackass, Borat, Mission Impossible 3, and Maverick. I do have a soft spot for that film.
I like Maverick, too. My other honorable mentions, Wrath of Khan, South Park, The Simpsons movie, The Untouchables, and even though we excluded it, The Blues Brothers is making my honorable mentions.
All right. Well, those are our top five TV show adaptations. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, The Incredible Hulk.
See it?
See it, though amiss. Fire, mostly, we would say. And The Happening.
Don't see it under any circumstances. If you know anybody that maybe got some free tickets for a screening of this thing, I am being completely deadly serious. Do not let them go.
Okay, you heard it here from Maddie Ballgame. Also, wanted to mention that In Bruges, a movie that we both liked and you really loved, Maddie, Martin McDonagh's film.
My favorite movie of the year.
Yeah, it is opening for a one-week engagement only here in Chicago, reopening. I mention it, though, because for all of our listeners outside of Chicago, it may be having other one-week engagements in other cities. I'm just not sure, so I did want to throw that out there. Next week's show is completely wide open at this point. We're definitely not going to review, I'm sorry, Mike Myers and the Love Guru, or Get Smart with Steve Carell, even though I love him, or Kit Kittredge, An American Girl, with the lovely, precocious Abigail Breslin.
Is that one of those Serenity spinoffs, too?
It might be. We did want to discuss Mongol, which opens in Chicago on the 20th, but we didn't get to the lone press screening, so that's out. Really, it's wide open. We're looking forward to any of your suggestions on what we should review. I know some people have already sent in our message boards that maybe the John Cusack film War, Inc., we should talk about that. We're not set on a top five either, so you can help decide what the content of the show will be. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Thanks, as always, to Candace for her production assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Ron Jones, and Tori Malatia at Chicago Public Radio, and to Shame Train for this week's music. Learn more at myspace.com/ShameTrain. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Don't you panic by the light of the night.
I hit the record button, by the way.
This is not going to show. My singing does not go in the show.
That's what the outtakes were made for, Maddie.
Shut the fuck up.
You're trying to ruin it? You're trying to sabotage it?
I fucking lie, you fucking piece of shit. Janice, you turn that fucking mic off. We'll do it. Fuck it. We'll do it live. We'll do it live.
You're now ensuring that he gets played as our outtake.
Have you seen that Bill O'Reilly? YouTube, Bill O'Reilly Outburst Inside Edition. He's just yelling at some fucking intern. He's just like, we'll do it live! Fuck it, we'll do it live!
We don't yell at our interns like that.
No. Jaime and Janice and Mortimer and Herkimer.
Ian.
And Ian and yeah. Fred and Liam.